Okay, I want to welcome you here. I give very brief introductions, and today, real pleased to have John with us, and John Horniker. He lives down near Lake Lure. We didn't have too far to come, and I've known John for almost 30 years now. We were reminiscing and catching up how we met in Sedona back in 1990 at a lightworkers gathering, and John is has an incredible story. I think of John because he's a little bit older than I am. So that people say, "Are you wise?" I said, "No, I'm not wise. I'm just old." You get a lot of experience the older you are. John's written several books, and he's got one we have in the library. It's a really, really good book, very readable. And anyway, so we ask people on at our Wisdom Circle to share the story of their spiritual journey and some of the insights they've gained along the way. And then, time permitting, open it up to discussion, feedback, talking about your own journeys, whatever. Nicholas, you're doing next week, aren't you?
I am.
Yeah, Nicholas is doing next week, and Helica is doing the week after that. And then we have some other people scheduled throughout the summer. So, without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to John.
Thank you,
Michael. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. A lot of good things happened to me throughout my life as a result of having met Michael, as he said, in about 1990. And I'll talk about some of those things today. But first, I think we'll start at the beginning in terms of my life and sort of where I started and, you know, how I sort of progressed through some of that, particularly with a focus on my spiritual awakening and my perspectives of life and the world and the world beyond Earth have changed and grown as I've gone through the years. But I grew up on a little farm outside of Portland, Oregon, about 30 miles outside of the city. And it was a small farm. A brother, older brother, and an older sister, and I was the baby of the family. Looking back on it, although it was a lot of work on the farm, I feel very, very fortunate in terms of having the opportunity to grow up in a family that had a loving relationship and a very supportive relationship. As I've gone through life, I realize that that's almost a rarity in terms of people being raised by parents who want the best for their children and help them along the way. So for that, I'm very grateful. I was born in December of 1936. You can do the math if you want. That makes me 81, I guess, now. When I was 5 years old then when the United States entered World War II. So World War II was an important experience in my early life, even though I was not touched directly by it. Also, 1936 was still during the Big Depression, and I think my life was probably as impacted as much by the Depression as it was during the war years. On the farm, we did not have electricity until I was 8 years old, so it was a pretty basic life, but we didn't know there was such a thing as electricity in terms of our life, and so you just learn to live with what you have, and that all worked out very well. I suppose it's sort of ironic not having electricity until I was 8, and then a dozen years later graduating with a degree in electrical engineering. I think there's some irony in that. Maybe that's why I was stimulated to learn more about electricity. Anyhow, I had a pretty normal life growing up. I grew up in a Protestant religious environment, and that was an important part of our family experience. And everything went along quite smoothly until my senior year at Oregon State, and my brother was killed in a plane crash, and that was sort of turned everything upside down for me. It's the first experience in my lifetime when I realized things would never be the same again. And looking back on it now, I'm grateful that that happened, as difficult as it was at the time. What it did was give me the emphasis to dig deeper into life and try to figure out, what is it we're really doing here? What is this all about if it can disappear so quickly? Incidentally, that story has a happy ending now, 60 years after his death. My sort of partner in life is a very gifted medium, and so she enjoys talking with people. What she calls, she likes dead people better than live people. She very easily connects with people on the other side. And so during about the last 5 years, my brother and I have reconnected through him. We have a lot of interesting visits. He likes Lillian, is her name. He likes Lillian, so he likes to hang out, and he'll pop in at times. So it's sort of like a brother that I lost 60 years ago, but he's back in my life now, and that's an interesting part of our journey. As I say, life went along pretty normal. After my brother was killed, initially it sort of drove me deeper into conventional religion, and then it didn't seem like I was finding any answers there, and so then it sort of drove me away from conventional religion, and eventually led me toward the spiritual metaphysical world, which we'll talk about now. It was, I'd always been interested in spaceships, and in the early 60s, I came across a book called The White Sands Incident. It was written by a person by the name of Daniel Fry, and in it he talked about his experience out in the desert in New Mexico, where he was taken aboard a spaceship, and of course I found that fascinating. But even more fascinating was he talked about his conversations with the beings that were aboard the ship, telling about the history of Earth and so on. I thought, wow, this is the first time I've really read something that makes sense. All this other stuff didn't ever seem to quite make a lot of sense, but there's something about this. So anyhow, at that point in time, Daniel Fry was having an annual conference in a little town in southern Oregon, and I was living in Portland at the time, and decided I'd go down and have a chance to meet him, and who knows, I might meet some other interesting people there. Well, indeed I did, and one of the people I met was a fellow by the name of Jack Schwartz, who was originally from the Netherlands, but at that point in time he was living in southern Oregon, but he was traveling up and down the west coast, starting from San Diego, working his way up through each of the major cities. I think there are about a half a dozen cities that he would spend 2 weeks in, or 2 weekends in, doing workshops, and then in the week in between you could have doing counseling sessions. And he was trained in, he was a doctor of naturopathy, but he primarily was a metaphysician. He had extended vision in terms of being able to see auras, so when we would have individual readings from him, it was primarily his extended vision and intuition that he would read from. And I finally, from that point on, I felt like, now I've found my life path. Now I'm with someone who has something to teach me. And so for the next 2 or 3 years, he was an important, every time he would come back through Portland, I would always sign up ahead of time. And so he was my first mentor. I say that because my life was really characterized over the next 2 or 3 decades by mentors coming into my life. They always say, when the student's ready, the teacher will appear. And I'm here to tell you that was certainly true in my life, and I trust it is for many of you too. Now we do have to act on it. If a teacher appears and we don't act on it and don't take advantage of it, then that doesn't do us much good. But my life really has been shaped very much by what I've learned through some of the important mentors in my life. I started waking up then at that point in time, and this now is in the late 60s, early 70s. In 1972, well, first of all, I had gone to work for the telephone company for what at that time was the Bell System when I got out of college. And in 1972, I was transferred to be the director of a AT&T training center in Denver, Colorado. And so the first thing I did when I got there was to look in the phone book for metaphysics, spirituality, whatever, and I found a spiritual center in Denver. And for the next 3 years of my experience in Denver, I spent more time probably at the spiritual metaphysical center than I did on my AT&T job. Fortunately, my job was not very demanding, but my interest had certainly shifted by that time. At that time, there were not a lot of books to use, and the textbooks, if you will, that we used in that spiritual center were the Life and Teachings of the Masters of the Far East. Some of you may be familiar with that series of books. They were written by Baird Spalding, and that was sort of our Bible, if you will, at that point in time. But that was that. By the time I had finished those 2 or 3 years in Denver, I was a very different person than I had been before. Spirituality was the total focus in my life. Although I continued my Bell System career, it was like I was living a double life. There was where my real interest was on the spiritual metaphysical part, and then where the other part of my life was that kept a roof over my head and bread on the table, so to speak. When I was in Seattle one time in the late 1970s, a few years after my Denver experience, I was looking through the metaphysical section of a bookstore, and there was a book there called Strangers Among Us. I don't know if any of you are familiar with that book, but it was written by Ruth Montgomery, and what she was writing about is this whole concept of walk-ins. Does walk-in, are any of you familiar with the idea of walk-ins? Okay. What the book was about was to talk about one of the ways that we can incarnate into a human body is we don't necessarily have to come through the birth process, that we can also, with the agreement of somebody who is already incarnated on the planet, we can so-called walk-in. That was a term that she sort of coined, was talking about walk-ins. These were people who had come in to a body that was already incarnated on the planet, but it's a new soul, and the souls would train places. So I would sort of, rather than the term walk-in, I prefer the term soul exchange, where the original birth soul leaves and a new soul comes in to take over the rest of the life. At that point in time, most of the time that would happen, it would be a more evolved soul that would come into the body. And part of the reason for that was to get more light workers into embodiment in an age bracket where they would be able to function more. It's sort of, in a sense, wasted time for a light worker to come in and go through the infancy years and so on, the early part of life. And so by coming into an already developed body, already to pursue the life mission in a broader sense, that's why a lot of walk-ins were coming in during that period of time. And as I say, in that period, although light workers were still coming in through the birth process and waves of those, we can talk about that more later. A lot of the light workers that were coming in there were using the walk-in process. As I look back over, I began reading the book like, oh, this is about me. This is about me. Oh, this is very familiar. And I realized that the reason I had become so deeply engrossed in spiritual metaphysical work during the early 1970s, and particularly during my time with the center in Denver, was because I had indeed done a walk-in or a soul exchange, and the soul that had come into the body was a different soul than the one that had grown up on the farm back out in Oregon so many years earlier. Moving on from that, then life continued, and in conjunction with my telephone company work, I was traveling to Minnesota occasionally, to Minneapolis, and on one of those trips met a lady there by the name of Judy Voss, who also was a very talented medium, had very direct contact with the other dimensions, and we became good friends. And usually when I would go to Minneapolis in conjunction with my phone company work, I always made sure I left enough time to get together with her in the evenings, and she would usually channel some of the beings. At that point in time, it was usually some of the so-called spiritual hierarchy, like Saint Germain, or she worked a lot with Mother Mary, or Jesus, Sananda, or beings like that, but they were all part of the ascended masters that we had associated with Earth at that point in time. After two or three years of that, one time I was in early 1974, I had stopped to visit and she was channeling, and I forget who it was on the other side, whether it was Saint Germain or it was someone like that, and they said, "Well, we have a surprise for you tonight. There is another group of beings who would like to make contact with you, and they're representatives of the Intergalactic Federation, and if you're open to it, and if Judy's able to make contact with them, we would like to have you get in touch with them." And she and I looked at each other and said, "Sure, why not?" And it turned out that she was able to make contact with them and channel them almost as easily as she had been those of the ascended beings of the spiritual hierarchy. And that began a whole new phase of life. And what their message was is that they were, although they were working under the auspices of the Intergalactic Federation, they were basically from the Pleiades, and that they were working with the technology that had been developed in the Pleiades. And what they wanted to be able to do was to assist Earth in raising the vibrations of the planet, and also in helping to clear out some of the dark energies at certain places around the planet. And they said, "We have one little problem, and that is because of the prime policy of non-interference," and I'll talk more about that a little later, "we're not permitted to just come in and shoot energy into planet Earth without being invited to do so by someone who's embodied on the planet. And since you and Judy are embodied on the planet, if you're willing to work with us, we'll set up a meeting point and you can go there and invite us, and we'll be ready with the ships and come in and start working with the planet in that area energetically." And they said the first location that they have in mind was Cusco in Peru. And we would, if we would meet them there on May the 11th, at such and such an hour, invite them, they would be overhead, they would make contact, and then they would start working with the energies there. So we thought, we're up for that. We always wanted to go to Peru anyhow, so we did that. We went to Peru and went to the meeting point, which was near one of the cathedrals in Cusco, and they began doing their work. Of course, as long as we were in Peru, we might as well extend our trip a little bit, and so we went up to Machu Picchu and took, you know, a week or 10 days to enjoy the trip. The next one after that, working with the same group of the ones in the ships, was in East Africa at the base of Kilimanjaro. And again, I think it was October of the year that we agreed to meet them there. It didn't take long to be there and extend the invitation to them. They would take over from there, do their work, so to speak, and she and I would be off going on safari. And so the work was not all bad. We felt a sense of satisfaction from being able to work in a constructive way with our friends from the Pleiades, and at the same time to be able to enjoy some of the scenery on life. At that point in time, they told us that there was a very large ship that was based over, anchored over Kilimanjaro, that they, it was about 2 miles long, and that they, it was a laboratory that they used. They liked, for ships that were that large, they liked to do it over a mountainous area because the structure of the earth is stronger and there's less danger of it setting off earthquakes or things like that. Also, as we began then to go on with other meet points, the next one was in Egypt, and then Kyoto, Japan, and then we spent a week in Patmos, in the Greek island of Patmos, which is where St. John had had his experience. It's written about in the Book of Revelations and the Bible, and so on. So we began to have other points throughout the world. We finally finished that series about 5 years later in the Palenque in the Yucatan was the final one we did. But it was that set us off in a whole new direction in terms of what we'd learned about the Pleiadians. And somewhere into that we realized that that we had been sort of set up in a sense, that we were really part of that task force group, that we had been working at, with them for a long time on the other dimensions. And it was just that we had volunteered to come in into embodiment, and that was one of the reasons for my walking experience, and that that soul needed to come into a human body so that it could then be a human citizen and therefore invite our friends to work with the planet in that way. Let's see where to go from here. That sort of set my life in a new direction in terms of seeing a much broader picture. And I think I'll skip ahead a little bit and then come back and pick up some of the other thing. In 1992, as we measure Earth time, there was what's called a cosmic conclave. The end of the cycle here on Earth coincided, the end of the cycle, which is generally related to the year 2012, the end of that cycle coincided with the end of a cycle of a much, much longer cycle that involved many, many, many different galaxies. And apparently near the end of those cycles, it's customary to have a conclave with representatives from each of the galaxies who are involved in the completion of that cycle. And the purpose of the meetings is to review the experiences of what the learning experiences had been for that particular cosmic cycle, put forth recommendations for the next cosmic cycle. I would not have known what my involvement was on the other side, but the being who was going to be one of the representatives from our galaxy, again, needed to be embodied on a planet. So here was John with nothing to do except to work for the phone company, and so that was my second walk-in experience. And each time it has been, at least from my perspective, has been an upgraded experience. But anyhow, for the next, from 1992 to the end of 1996, was when that conclave took place. I would not have known much about it because I don't have memory of those, but by that time I had a close friend who I came to refer to as my cosmic scientist friend. His name was Rendell. He crossed over a couple, 3 years ago, so I can talk openly now about some of the things I would not have been able to before. He was an infiltrate. An infiltrate is someone who is from the higher dimensions but working on special assignment here on Earth. One of the best example of that probably is after the U.S. dropped the atomic bombs on Japan in 1945, the decision was made at the higher realms that humanity was not going to be permitted to destroy the planet. And therefore, there was going to be an exception made to the prime policy of non-interference, and the Intergalactic Confederation would be assigned the responsibility to make sure, make absolutely certain, that there would be no use of atomic or nuclear weapons here on Earth. That obviously has been successful up to this point in time, but there are in conjunction with that mandate and with all of the assistance from the Intergalactic Federation, there are numerous infiltrates who are on the planet living as human beings and carrying out their mission from the higher dimensions. And Rendell, my new friend, was one of those people who was an infiltrate. To some extent, he was working with that mandate, but he was also working with other aspects of it. Because of that, they were permitted to remember things that most of us are not permitted to. And by the time I got to know him well, he was at the point where when he went to sleep at night, his memory just kept right on recording. So he remembered everything that happened throughout his nighttime experiences, just as we do everything that happened during our daytime human experiences. It was a real challenge for him because, so he has 12 hours now of human experience, now 12 hours of intergalactic experience up on the ships and doing all the things he was doing there. And then he wakes up again in his body, still in a human form, and another 12 hours. So it's very challenging for people who are fulfilling those roles. One of the roles of me in relationship to him was that he was going to be a teacher for me, and I could be an Earth friend for him that he could talk more openly to, that there really wasn't anybody else, or at least very few people in his life, that he could share some of those experiences with. So he became my important mentor for a long period of time. And bringing that back now to the Cosmic Conclave, as he explained to me, there are two aspects of the conclave. One is the general conclave, and the other one is the scientific one. He was involved with the scientific one, and I, in my higher self, was involved in the cosmic conclave that was of the general part of it. So coming out of that, although I did not get anything in terms of direct memory, I was aware that I was doing some very, very long trips during that period of time to other galaxies, other universes. And when we do that and we're in physical form, it takes a little while for the body to adjust to that. And I was living sort of in semi-seclusion during that period of time on the western slope in Colorado. And not much else going on in my life at that point. By that time, I had retired from the telephone company, and so I could be pretty much free to focus on these cosmic trips. What happens, you go out, and let's say the trip takes the equivalent of 2 weeks, you might be out, but then when you come back, you time phase back, so your time phase back in, you know, maybe 10 minutes after you time phased out. And so there's a lot of time phasing going on. The way we experience that sometimes in the physical body, it puts a lot of stress on the intestinal part of the physical body, and I was always filled with my legs. So if I'd wake up in the middle of the night and feel strangeness in my legs, it's like, uh-oh, I've been out in the stars again. On the shorter trips, it's not such so taxing on the body, but on the long trips where there's longer time period, so-called time periods involved. So that was another part of my experience. Carrying over now to some of my life experiences that were really facilitated through my connection with Michael. As you mentioned, we met at a conference in 1990. About a year after that, 1991, he had been in touch with some people over in the United Kingdom, Errol Weiner and Amy Masters, a couple who had met at at Findhorn in Scotland, and they were in the process of setting up a get-together between the light workers of Eastern Europe and the light workers of Western Europe. By that point in time, that was 1991, that was 2 years after the beginning of the breakup of the Soviet Union. And by that time, the light workers, the spiritually oriented people in Eastern Europe, were finally free to come out and practice their spirituality more openly. And Eero and Amy thought it would certainly be interesting to bring some of those people together with their counterparts in Western Europe. Michael had learned about it and arranged for us to be invited. There were four of us who went over and participated at the conference, and that was an incredibly important experience for me. There were about 100 people, a little over 100 people, most of them actually from the Eastern European countries. It was the first time that I'd had an opportunity to meet and interact with people from Eastern Europe, since they were pretty much not allowed to do that so openly during the years of the Soviet Union. But I enjoyed it so much that I decided I wanted to go back and reconnect with some of the people who were at the conference. So later that year, in the fall of that year, as I say, I'd retired by that time, so I just packed a backpack full of some clothes and a few other things and got on the plane, flew to Zurich, and from that point on, I didn't have anything scheduled laid out. I just used the train system in Western Europe and Eastern Europe to travel through Hungary, and at that time it was still Czechoslovakia and Poland and some of the countries that we had met people from at the conference in England. That about 2 years later, there was a follow-up conference in Bulgaria, and again I used the train system to get to the conference. It was held on the little town of Burgas on the Black Sea, and walked in. When I walked in the conference, there was a woman sitting. Actually, we used the bus to get there. She was the one that had been sort of coordinating the conference. Her name was Natasha Stavreva, and we looked at each other's eyes, and it was like, oh Lordy, how do we know each other from who knows where? But it's amazing how you can go halfway around the world into a totally different environment and meet people that we were intended to meet. Now, we have a lot of help with that, and so I'm sure some of you have experienced similar experiences, each in your own way. But there, on their other side, there are a group of beings who work as facilitators for that. Their job basically is to help bring people together who have made contracts with each other prior to coming into embodiment. They help bring them together at the right point in time in their lives. And so we knew that, in fact, as Natasha and I got acquainted with each other, we realized that that she had almost come to the same conference that Michael and I had gone to in England, and at the last minute had to cancel out of it. So the facilitators are sometimes called synchronizers. So the synchronizers had to start over, and they thought, oh, we missed it. We were supposed to get John and Natasha together at that conference. Now, since she didn't show up, now we got to figure out another way to do it. So they made sure that we met at the conference in Bulgaria. That's sort of the way that life has been working. And of course, throughout all of that process, I've been trying to understand what's going on here on planet Earth. One of the things I learned out of my work with the Cosmic Conclave is that Earth is coming to a completion point in this cycle. And another thing had happened, and that is that Mother Earth Gaia, the being that inhabits Earth, in other words, Earth is her body, Mother Earth, had put forth a request that she be freed from continuing on with this whole experiment in duality that had begun many millennia ago. Somewhere along this, the idea was to experience duality, being that experience what life would be like if we were not consciously aware of our connection with the Creator. That was the whole idea of it. But that experiment was hijacked a long, long time ago. A lot of the sources now say that that happened about 13 millennia ago. It was taken over by a group of beings who had lost their way. They're the dark beings who have been creating the wars and all of the havoc, the cruelty, the greed, all of the things that go along with that throughout these past many, many millennia. Mother Earth put forth a request to the higher realms saying, I've had enough of this. I'm time to move on. I don't want to, I want to be given the permission to move back up to where I was in the higher realms of consciousness. So Mother Earth Gaia has been granted the okay to ascend back up to the point where her lowest frequency of expression will be in the fifth dimension, in contrast to the third dimension where it has been for all these many millennia. What that means is that she is moving forward with her ascension process. Those of us who are embodied on the planet have the opportunity to ascend with her, and many of us have chosen that pathway, whether we know it consciously or not. Many of us have chosen to ascend with Mother Earth Gaia, but there are still many, many souls that are embodied on the planet who have no idea who they are. They're still stuck in the darkness. And so they're probably the majority of souls embodied on the planet will not be ascending with her, which means that at some point in time, Mother Earth will exist only fifth dimension above, which is above the realm of duality. From that point on, there will be no dark beings embodied on planet Earth, on the ascended version of planet Earth. So somehow or another, the ones who are on Earth now, who are not making the ascension journey, will be reassigned to other planets who are at a more similar vibration to third dimensional Earth now. And how that happens is an opportunity for a lot of speculation, but I don't think any of us know how that's actually going to play out. The important thing is that we don't have to wait for everything to get resolved within the third dimensional reality. For me, that's terribly encouraging, because when I look at what's happening around the planet, looking within the U.S. government and other countries around the world, I think, Lordy, if I live another million years, I'm not sure this is going to get resolved. And therefore, one can focus on, okay, my path is the path of ascension. What is it that I need to do to best facilitate my ascension pathway? And of course, that's living from our heart, living with love and caring, rather than, sometimes it's called service to others instead of service to self. That's the shift we need to make as we move through ascension. And so for me, the lesson that has for us is that we don't have to solve all the problems on the human level. When I see what's going on, like what we're learning from this past week of all the stuff around immigration policy and all the terrible stuff that's happening at the hands of our government, it's like, what is our choice? And it's not an easy choice. It's not an easy choice to stay in touch with that, to see what's happening, to not get angry about it, and not want to go out there and do something directly about it. And at the same time, to stay anchored in higher consciousness, saying there is something much larger playing out here. And of the two things that are important, yes, I can probably do something directly if I wanted to help a little bit with the situation that's going on a third dimensional level. But my real destiny is the fifth dimension and above. And what's most important to me is to take advantage of this ascension opportunity. And I think for those of us who are light workers, those of us who are on the ascension pathways, I'm sure most of you are, whether you know it or not, those are the choices we have to make, is how far do we go in terms of staying in touch with what's going on in the third dimensional world, in the old third dimensional paradigm, versus how much do we stay focused on higher consciousness and create our lives still on planet Earth, but create our lives which involve people, other people who are on the ascension pathway, instead of other people who are struggling along and still stuck in the darkness. And I think that's sort of the challenge and the dilemma that we as light workers have at this point in time. One other thing I'd like to talk about, and that is, and then I'll sort of open it up for anything you'd like to share and question, and that is that there have been a lot of light workers who when they signed their contract to come in, the contract was that they would stay at least through the end of this cycle, which officially was the end of 2012. And so there are a lot of light workers who have fulfilled their basic contract, and now have been given the opportunity that if they want to leave, they have a choice of how they can do it. One is through a physical death, or there's another choice, and that is that they could do a walkout, they could do a soul transfer, let someone else come in, take over the body, finish out the life. And what Lillian and I have personally been observing over the last 2 or 3 years is that a large number of people seem to be making their body available for another soul to come in. These are not necessarily upgrades, but in some cases more like a placekeeper soul to come in and finish out the incarnation. But I wanted to share that because some of you may be experiencing that as well. Let me just put it in personal terms. In the past 3 years, I guess, two of my grandchildren and one of my daughters has opted for that out. And so as I look at my grandchildren, they were about 8 years old at the time they decided to leave. One of them I knew before she came in was going to be a highly evolved soul. She came in and stuck with it for about 8 years and said, "Enough, I'm out of here." And she made her body available for another soul to come in. I didn't know from those realms what had happened, but as I was watching pictures of her that my daughter was sending to me, it's like, I look back, this is not the daughter I knew 2 years ago. And then I began to realize what was happening. Some of you may be having those experiences in your own life, where some people who've been friends and acquaintances for a long period of time, all at once they just don't seem like the same person anymore. And maybe it's because they're not the same person anymore. Maybe it's because they have done a soul exchange. And we're observing more and more and more of it. I suppose the walk-in phenomena is of interest to me for a while, beginning in the mid-1990s. I got involved with an organization called WE International. The focus of it was started by a woman who had been through a walk-in experience herself. It had been very confusing for her, and she thought, one of the things I can do in life is to form an organization so that other walk-ins who are confused about what's happened in their life, in their body, have a place to come to for information. And so she formed this organization called WE International, and would have a conference once or twice a year, inviting walk-ins to come inviting people who think they might be a walk-in to come and learn more about the walk-in phenomena. It turns out she was already in her late 60s, I think, by the time she formed the organization, and eventually was dealing with a cancer situation. So I took over the organization for a couple of years, and so had a chance. I say that only because it has given me a chance to meet a lot of walk-ins who have gone through various experiences related to that whole concept of soul exchange. And I suppose that's why I find that so fascinating still at this point in time. So let's take a break at that point. Anything that you'd like to share that relates to any of that or that doesn't relate to any of that?
Well, right offhand, I just have to tell you, I'm so thankful you're talking about this. I literally just came from Cusco, Peru. I have a friend there right now that I met in a Iquitos almost 2 months ago, and there's something about him. And one night, like, we were doing an ayahuasca ceremony, like, something spoke to me and told me to go to him, and I channeled in some, there were extraterrestrials. I looked up and I saw him, and they were, like, pouring down this, like, I heard like acceleration, realignment, recalibration stuff into him. And he was like, I don't know what is wrong with me. I feel like there's something going on. There's like crazy stuff. And I feel like I processed some of his stuff for about 2 days and everything realigned for him. And he's like taken off. And he's in Cusco right now studying, working with energy, you know, like as many teachers as he can, trying to figure out what's going on. And so thank you for speaking, because I feel like he's supposed to hear this talk. So I'm so glad that you're recording it, and I think it's going to fill in a lot for him, because he was told, he like told me a few days ago that someone told him he's a leader from another planet that's here, and he's like, this is crazy to me. And he's like 22-year-old guy from Denmark, no experience, and then suddenly just boom, something woke up in him, and he's on this journey. And I feel like your talk is so much insight to that, so just thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
And also, I'm very curious to know, what are these symptoms of walk-in? Like, if you personally, or if we personally are experiencing this, I would love to hear, you know, just what some of the symptoms are that people may experience.
I would say that the experience is varies quite dramatically from person to person. Most people, I would say the majority, are not aware of something as dramatic as perhaps what you're describing. Yeah. In my own case has been much more gentle than other people's walk-in experiences. To give you an example of one of my friends who came in as a walk-in, she remembers coming in on the ship. The agreement had been worked out with the body that she was going to project into. At the appropriate point in time, the current soul in the body was going to leave, had agreed to leave, and she was going to project down from a ship into the body and come into embodiment in that way. She said at the last moment, the soul who had agreed to leave was having second thoughts, and they almost lost the body. The body almost died because the transition was not as smoothly as it could have been. But she said her first memory of being in the body was looking down at her legs and thought, oh my God, what have I done? So for her, those initial stages were fairly traumatic. Another person that we met through the walk-in organization woke up one morning and thought, who had this guy in bed with me? It was her husband. But it was like, all of a sudden, for her, whoever she had become, it was like a total stranger, someone that she didn't know and didn't want to know. And she looked in her closet, she was going to get up and put some clothes on, and she looked in her closet and she couldn't find, they weren't the colors that she wanted to wear, they weren't clothes that we're familiar with. It was like someone had just been dropped in from another dimension into a marriage situation that she wanted no part of, into a life situation in terms of clothing and living patterns and so on that was totally different. So for some people, it's very traumatic and very dramatic. for me and for the majority of people, it's much more gentle. Like in the case of my two granddaughters, I don't think their mother, my daughter, I don't think she still has a clue as to what happened. And I've decided, I've sort of wrestled with that, but I've sort of decided now it's not for me to carry that message to her. It's like saying, your daughter's not who you think she is. It also, another person who had come in as a walk-in felt so different that the daughter that she had had before the soul exchange, she always talks to the daughter in third person. So it's like, well, her daughter, her being the person that she was before the walk-in experience, and so it's like now it's this new person sort of adopting this child that was actually physically born through that body, but the change in perspective was so traumatic that it's sort of like and a lot of people have trouble integrating who they have become with who they have been. And I had some difficulty with that at times, but now having been through two major walk-in situations, I've sort of learned to look back, and like when I had these conversations with my brother, who's now in the other dimensions, I have my conversations with him, it's sort of like, yeah, I feel more integrated now, and I can talk with my sister is still in embodied, I can talk with them in terms of the childhood part of my body. I don't remember details as well as most people would, but I feel that integration is an important part of it. And for my own purpose, I'm trying to see these 80 years as sort of one continuous continuum, even though it sort of breaks into three phases, my before awakening phase, my phase after my first walk-in, my phase after my second walk-in. And I've had conversations with them upstairs, and I said, twice is enough. I, as long as I stay here on the planet in a body, if my soul needs to leave, take the body too. That I don't want to go through this. I don't want to do a downgrade for these last 10 or 20 years of my life. And so we have some say in it, but we can also get overridden from the other side.
I have three questions. This one's easy. The next two, you can feel free to skip. The first question is, have you seen the movie K-Pax?
Yeah.
Awesome movie.
Yeah.
Sounds similar to this
ball. There's a lot of similarity in it.
Yeah. The next two questions are, when's the last time you had a good cry? And why?
When I had a good cry?
Yeah.
Boy, that's an interesting question. I can't remember the last time I cried.
Long ago, though?
Certainly during the period of my brother's death, you know, there was lots of crying time for that. During my first divorce, there was crying time with that. But I would say that generally speaking, there's been a lot less crying after my first walk-in. Mm-hmm. That from that part of my life on, first of all, my life has been happier, easier, flowing, and it's, situations in life are easier to deal with if you know
who you are, why you're here, what it's all about.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
I have a question about it feels to me really irresponsible of souls in the fifth dimension to walk out on what's happening right now. And I feel like that part it seems odd. Why would highly evolved beings feel comfortable leaving Earth right now?
It's an excellent question. Each of us have to make our own choice. For me, because of the perspective I have in terms of the whole ascension plan, I may be wrong about that, but that's my understanding of it. For me, that gives me all the reason in the world to want to stay here, to want to be part of this experiment, and this is an experiment, and simply the knowing that there will come a time in on ascending earth or ascended earth where there no longer is all of this interruption and interference by the dark forces. And we don't have to wait for all of that to get resolved on a human level. So what we need to do is focus on the ascension opportunity and to stay in alignment with ascension consciousness. And to give you an example in my own life, what I do with that is quite often in my meditations, I'll go through a process of saying, if there is anything in any aspect of my beingness, whether from this lifetime or any other lifetimes, if there is anything that is not in alignment with ascension consciousness, I ask that that be lifted from me now and transmuted into the light, and in place of that, that I be filled with love, with energies of pure love and pure light. And I do that periodically as part of my own meditative process to help me stay focused. And also, when I've been watching TV, the evening news on television and see what's going on, it's human nature to get very angry about some of the things that are going on. And for me, it helps give me a way of staying balanced and being aware of what's happening on the planet, but at the same time not getting caught up in all of the negative emotions associated with that. I can also understand, though, that for those souls who came in as light workers, who came in to whether they knew it or not, to help with the ascension process, and they look around and see what looks like hopelessness in terms of the progress that's being made. If I didn't have a better perspective of myself, of what I think the plan is that's unfolding, I can see where I might choose to leave. But the reason I ask not to is because I do have a different vision of what's going on and what's happening, and that we are going to simply lift up out of the darkness. We don't have to wait till everything gets solved at the level of darkness. I don't know if that's...
Yeah. That answers.
Okay.
That's a question. I'm curious as to what happens to that first entity that lived in the body.
It basically,
so your 8-year-old self, where did he go?
In the case of my granddaughter.
Oh, when you had your first walk in.
Yeah. Okay.
Where did
that outgoing soul go? It just as though it had gone through a physical death, and it goes back to continue on. Life in the higher realms, in the non-physical realms, just like it would if the body had died. Very, very little difference between the two.
How does the walk-in know that he was willing to end?
How does the walk-in know that there has been
that,
a walk-in?
That previous entity is willing to...
How was the exchange arranged?
That's an agreement that's worked out at the soul level. It's not worked out at the human level.
Okay.
It's worked out at the soul level. And that's why the majority of walk-ins do not know that they're walk-ins. And they may realize that they have gone through changes in personality, but the majority of them probably don't even know that they've gone through a walk-in.
So with the whole walk-in thing, like, do you, when it does happen, because clearly you have memory of you as a child, but it's like apparently it's like a new soul. So does that mean you're the body, or because if you were like, if that was you, like whatever that was, the previous soul left, does its consciousness and its first person point of view go with it, and then it sees like etheric places and stuff, or like why do you have recollection of like previous and then the point where you like the soul that came in?
The incoming soul inherits the memory of the original soul. And so in that sense there's no loss of continuity. And that's why most people don't realize that they are now a different soul than they were prior to the walk-in experience. What I have found in my own life is that my memory of detail of the early part of my life is very vague. Like my mother, when she was 95, she could tell me about an experience she had, or you know, like maybe their family had gone down to the beach when she was 7 years old, and she could remember where they had dinner and da da da. You know, she remembered infinite detail about things that had happened in her childhood. For me, I have vague recollections, but I don't have. Well, to give you, I was mentioning to Michael earlier today that my older sister, who's a couple of years older than I am, is now dealing with dementia or Alzheimer's. And I, just about a month ago, I spent a couple of days with her, and her long-term memory, her memory of our childhood together, is probably better than my memory is. But when it comes to what happened, and memory of what happened 20 seconds ago, that's where she's suffering with the dementia part of it. But I say that to say that although I have memory of my childhood, it's not detailed memory like it was prior to the walk-in experience.
So the new soul is shocked when it realizes it's inherited the bad knees and bad relationships.
Yeah.
So then, if say for instance you have another walk-in experience like a year from now, you speaking, it's not going to be you anymore? Are you going to be somewhere else, and then if another like walk-in happens, it's not going to be you? Or is it going to be you because you have a continuity of a recollection of memory?
That's where you have to sort of back up a little bit and say, who is this thing you call you? Yeah, who is this? And that's what I had found in working with walk-ins. The ones that had the greatest difficulty were the ones who felt disassociated from the early part of their life. And one of the things I learned out of that is that it's important to integrate that memory, realizing that yes, whoever it was in this body when this body was 10 years old, it's different, but there still is, if I think of this lifetime of 80 years as an integrated process, yes, there are three phases to it, one before the first walk-in with the original birth soul, then there's this period of time with the first walk-in or the second soul in the body, and then there's a period of time after 1992 when the second walk-in happened. And so, yes, it's broken up into phases, but I think it's the healthiest if we can sort of integrate the two and say, yes, this, in one sense, from a human perspective, it's a continuum. From a soul perspective, there has been just shifts going on.
I just have two more questions and I'm done.
No problem.
Is it possible for two souls to be stuck in one body or multiple souls? Or is it when there's an exchange? It's
very good question. Very good question. It is possible for two souls to share an experience for a period of time, And for, see, how do I get it to? Let me start on the other end of it. We'll start on the other end of it, which I call entities. There are disembodied entities around the planet who don't know that they've died, or who may know that they're died, but they have not gone on with their life in the non-physical realms. You see this a lot with souls who have addictions, whether it's addiction to alcohol, whether it's addiction to sex, whether it's addiction to gambling, whatever. If you go to places like a gambling casino, if you could see some of the entities that were there, not in physical form, you would say, let me out of here before one of those crawls in with me. And what happens in so many cases, an entity will come in if a body is not well protected. And it may stay for a day, it may stay for 10 years, it may stay for the remainder of the lifetime. There are many, many souls or people on this planet who have entities integrated into them with their true soul, and who are impacted usually in a non-positive way. Usually an entity possession is never a positive experience. Now, sometimes, like, let me give you an example. Again, going back to my friend Lillian, one time early in our friendship with each other, there was a soul who had not been embodied on planet Earth before, was considering coming into embodiment, but wanted to have an experience of what it would really be like to be in a physical body. So with the permission of Lillian's soul, and with the assistance and support of our mentors in the higher realms, they arranged for this soul to come in for a period of about 7 days, to come into the body, experience what it was like to be in a human body, and then at the end of the time had agreed to leave, which it indeed did leave. It was an interesting experience for me, knowing what was going on, but knowing the person I'm living with is not who it was last week. But in that case, it was all arranged and monitored and carefully controlled from the other dimension. There are other times when, by invitation, we are overlighted, and it's not like a full embodiment, but a soul will come partway in. It's sort of, I'm trying to think of an example, sort of like my brother that I was talking about. When Lillian is acting as a medium, for he and I to have a conversation, it's as though he sort of merges in with that body, and sort of his experiences of being in the body. We sort of forget about bodies and are just talking with each other, reminiscing about our childhood or whatever it is we're talking about.
Healers do that too. Healers, very often. They don't know the healing techniques, but they open up. And they're overshadowed by a higher dimensional healer that will work through them. It's not possessing them, but just working through them. You know, the example that I use, kind of touching on what you said, is like, certainly my memory, I just see this as a vehicle I'm traveling in. So this is my automobile. And, but some people can have their car carjacked, which is like possession. Others might just simply have some riders, some hitchhikers, pick up some hitchhikers that may be with them a while, and it might cause depression. There's all kinds of things, but they're actually called hitchhikers. And but kind of touching on what you said, if you are in certain places, like where there are addictions or predominant, like perhaps bars or casinos or whatever, it's kind of like driving through a really bad neighborhood with your window down. You're kind of inviting.
I love that, Michael.
You're kind of inviting a carjack, you know, for somebody to come in and take over, you know, and kick you out. This vehicle, at some point, is either going to wear out or be in an accident. So I'll be without a vehicle for a period of time. And then maybe get a new vehicle, and it depends on lots of things. But that's just the way I see my body, is just a vehicle, you know, of traveling in. And if you're going to be in some places that are a little, as the English say, dodgy, you want to keep your windows up.
Well, again, my friend Lillian, for a period of time, maybe 10 years ago, 10 or 15 years ago, a lot of the work that she was doing was helping people release entities. There are people, you know, spiritual counselors who specialize in that kind of work. But it's not a fun line of work. And some of the entities, when they're being told they have to leave, don't react very kindly to it. And there, it got to the point where Lillian would not work with someone unless I was there to be physically present, because sometimes the reactions were not very pleasant. And now she's said, that's not my line of work anymore. I don't do that. If you want some help, there are people who do that, but I'm not one of the people that can help with that anymore.
You know, there's stories too. I mean, this is kind of a common story of people getting completely drunk and then not remembering anything that took place. And it's like they're gone, someone else is in doing, saying, or acting. You know, I mean, the prisons are full of people that did things that I don't even remember doing it, you know, type thing. So, like, for some people, I don't think it's true of all people, but for some people, you know, over-consuming alcohol is like opening your door and your window in a bad neighborhood, you know, because you're just inviting in. But other people have more firm control on the wheel, and it's not a danger. It kind of varies from person to person, I think. I think that's true of anything, drugs, alcohol, anything that's going to open you up to other dimensions, period, you know.
You know, taking it around back to the more positive side of that, I mentioned the prime policy of non-interference. What that says is that someone of a higher evolved state cannot interfere with, in any way, with the life of another person unless they're invited to do so. So one of the things that's important for all of us to be aware of, and that is that if we want help from the higher realms, whether it's from the angelic realm, whether it's from simply our mentors in the other realms, or whoever, from beings of light, we'll say, if we want help, we can ask for help and put forth the request. Once the request is put forth, that frees them up to come in and assist us. Whereas, unless we invite them, they can't do that. I don't know if any of you are familiar with a woman called Lorna Byrne. She has worked a lot with angels. She has been able to see and interact with angels ever since being a young girl. When she was young, she didn't realize that not everybody could do that, not everybody could see angels. Anyhow, what she always talks about is all of the unemployed angels. There are so many angels standing by, ready and willing to work, wanting to be able to assist, and are not permitted to. So if we want to put some of those angels to work, all we have to do is put forth the request, will you please help me with this? And they're very good at it. They're very good at it.
So say you don't want to end your life, but you want to, like, whatever, whoever and whatever you are that sees and experiences and hears things and with your mind and all that wants to leave or go somewhere else. You're saying to achieve that, you request it? What does that mean to request? What do you mean by that? Like, what are the methods to get someone to walk in and when you leave?
Those decisions are made at the soul level. from a human level, one could certainly put forth a request to one's higher self saying, I've about had it here. If it is within the highest good for me to leave, I'm willing to do that and make my body available to another soul. But the decision point is at the soul level, not at the human level. But we can certainly put forth a request.
So if it's at the soul level, and then you yourself say that, and it doesn't happen, what is it like? Does it essentially become a prison if you don't want to be here? Are you forced here? Obligated? What's the deal with that?
Well, only a prison to the extent that everybody who comes in. I think we all have...
That's pretty profound.
I think we all have points at a period of time in my life. Like, what was I thinking when I agreed to come into embodiment here on Earth? But those are hopefully fleeting points, not something that sticks with us for a long time.
And
one of the things my Rendell, the infiltrate that I was talking about, says the big joke in the universe, or the common saying in the universe, on most planets in terms of difficulty are rated on a scale of 1 to 25. And 25 being the most difficult, they say that Earth is a 27. It's off the scale in terms of difficulty.
Okay. It's funny you brought up casinos, because I've always thought of Earth as the Las Vegas of the universe. Everybody wants to get here. And then, of course, once they're here, it's so festive. Everyone, not everyone, but a lot of people are like, oh, I've got to go. But I think... for me, what I find is even the souls that have a contract, if you will, to come here, or they have a mission, I'll use that word more than contract. What I find is the ones that are trying to exit and get out so quick is because they don't understand the bigger picture. They have yet to see the bigger picture. Because if they understood, it changes things. You know, I was one of the people that was like, what the heck did I... choose here, like, and I was angry about it. But then I had to, when I gained understanding as to what my mission was here and what I'm doing here, and I was open to flow with it, that subsided. I know now that, yeah, it's not, you know
who you are, why you're here,
exactly.
What it's all about.
It's totally different. And I think that it seems like the souls that come here and they're taken by the density of the place and the and what goes on, and they get enticed with the little minimums down here, it's very hard to function at that point. That's when they want to exit. It's like, oh, I didn't sign up for this. It's horrible.
Then, most of us, if you've lived long enough, can look back and see some of the worst things that ever happened, or some of the best things,
yeah,
in terms of your own soul growth.
Absolutely.
And so making that soul decision... The humans say, oh my God, what have I done, you know? And the soul, at a soul level, they say, this is a part of your curriculum, this is part of your education. And if you do get through it, your soul growth is going to be so much greater. Or you can start over again, you know. You can drop out of school and start over again. But it's going to happen, whether it takes 600 lives or 6,000, you know. But for your highest good, and that's where you... brought the point of the highest good. The soul's looking at the highest good, and so it's like, okay, for your highest good, stay with it and move through it, because you look back, you're going to find that, I mean, one of the worst periods of my life, when I was crying every day for 3 months. I don't want to go through it again, but it was a real major turning point for me. I had to hit absolute rock bottom to have a foundation for taking off, because as long as I didn't hit bottom, I couldn't take off. And so that was, as I said, I wouldn't want to repeat any of it, okay? But it's the best thing that ever happened, because I did a flip, you know. And now, had that not happened, I probably would have been stuck in some office under fluorescent light and a gold watch after X number of years, and now figuring out what I'm going to do the rest of my life, bored to tears, rather than being living in paradise and being unbelievably happy.
One last question. These souls extend beyond humans and incorporate into all living things, trees, plants, birds, anything like that? Do all these things have souls as well?
I believe that that's true. I certainly, in terms of the of animals like elephants and whales and dolphins, who are very conscious beings, my soul could I think choose to incarnate as an animal of that form. I personally believe that I have had been embodied as a tree spirit, that I have a special relationship with trees, and my awareness is that it's because I have an aspect of this consciousness, had that experience of being a tree, maybe more than once. I feel that we can also do that with other animals. I think people in this lifetime who are so, like our friend Rosie, who's so drawn to water, she is the happiest when she's in water, and there's no question in my mind but what she's had incarnations as a dolphin or a whale or whatever. Lillian has, my friend has had incarnations of a whale. So there's opportunity for crossover.
I've heard rumors, now I don't know if it's true or not. I've heard rumors that even Republicans have seen. I'm not sure.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting experiment. I think we should. That's enough.
How do you define higher power?
Higher power? Well, I see it as sort of hierarchical in structure. I think that there is, within the galaxy, there is a being, which is probably embodies the both male and female aspect, but there is a being that is the supreme authority in that galaxy. And the same thing with a universe of 12 galaxies or whatever. I think there is a supreme being with overall responsibility and authority related to the entire universe. So I see it as sort of hierarchical, not unlike a picture of a snowflake. It's sort of like if the God force, if the ultimate God force is in the center of it, then it's sort of like a circular organization chart, so to speak. That's sort of my vision of the way it works. I'm not saying that that's right, but that's sort of my vision of the way it works. When I'm talking to them upstairs, one of the things I do frequently is give thanks for creating the God self that I am. And when I direct that, it's to Father God, Mother Goddess. And it's sort of like, in my frame of reference, it's like, let them figure it out who I'm talking to. You know, I'm in my human self, I'm talking to somebody out there who created the God self that I am. And let them figure out who deserves the credit for that. But I want to know that whoever it is, I want them to know that I'm thankful for that. So that's sort of where I am, but then let them figure it out.
I have a curiosity, John, and you may know or not know about this, but so a long while ago I was listening to a story, and within this recount story was the fact that some of the German scientists that were taken out of Germany during World War II, what they had done was they had removed, after they
They got to be a certain age. They had removed the souls out of those bodies and placed them into new bodies. And I was just so curious as to how the heck they did that, because it didn't sound like this was coming from like a higher level. It just sounded more like there was like groups of
technology.
Yeah, thank you. Technology here that was transferring those souls, because they were talking about how some of them were like, you know, it could be the young pizza boy down the, you know, around the corner that was posing as that, but he had all that knowledge from his German days, and this is why they were doing that, and they were doing that with a lot of them. And I thought, how are they doing that? Like, it just, I don't know. I was just so curious as to, because they seem to be fully aware. They're bringing in the soul knowledge of, I've always looked at the soul, and maybe this is the wrong way to look at it, but I've always thought of it as your memory stick or your computer, USB. You know, like, it seems to store memory from all lifetimes within it. So I was just wondering, it's like, it's interesting, how could they transfer it over into a new body, and the new body automatically remembers, because they're not doing it from birth. These are like teenage boys, but they're remembering full knowledge of like all of their scientific knowledge from this last, you know, I wouldn't even use timeline at this point, because they're just being transferred over.
Did you watch any of the series of Corey Good and David Wolcott?
Yes.
Yeah. To me, I think what you're talking about, anybody else see that series on, there's a website called Gaia.com, and one of the people who has shared a lot of information through that media, through that website, is a person by the name of Corey Good. And when he was rather young, I think in his teenage, when he left in his teenage years, he signed up for a program of 20 years, I believe it was, that he would work in service in the galactic realms. And so he lived, fulfilled that whole mission in a non-physical, well,
try to explain that one.
He had this whole 20 years of experience of stuff that's way beyond our human conscious awareness. And then when that 20 years was up, he was regressed age-wise back to, again, time phasing, where to a period shortly after he left. In other words, when he was taken out, let's say he was 13 years old, just as an example, in his bedroom, after these 20 years of experience he's had in this other realm, then he was time phased back into being in his bedroom when he was 13 years, maybe 2 minutes later, 13 years older, and going through all that again. And the idea of that would be that the 13-year-old would not remember any of those experiences. What they found is that some of those people are able to, after a period of time, start to bridge memory across and start to retrieve some of that memory. And now he was at the point where he had pretty much full retrieval of what went on during those 20 years.
It was unbelievable.
Yeah. If you want to watch some interesting stuff, that's really a good one. Corey Good and David Wolcott.
We've gone, it's 12:30 already.
Oh, yeah.
This has been really, really fascinating.
Well, thank
and
you.
Helpful and informational, and thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
I really appreciate it. And it is one of the best ones we've had. So thank you for being here.
Thank you.